Good morning from 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. Now welcome to our election special candidates forum. As each Saturday this month, we speak to one candidate running for local or state office. The program is brought to you with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First and Main. Now here are your hosts, Bob McAdams and Jeff Leonard.
Good Saturday morning, everyone. I'm Jeff Leonard, founder and general manager of 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
And I'm Bob McAdams, special events coordinator at WPVC.
And today we're co-hosting a WPVC election special, one of our four interviews with Democratic candidates for Charlottesville City Council. Keep in mind, WPVC does not endorse any candidate for public office. We provide this information to you to help our listeners choose the best candidate that represents your interests.
With us in the studio this morning is City Council candidate Michael Payne. Michael, welcome to WPVC.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Michael, let's start by getting to know a little bit about you. Where were you born? What was your life like as you were growing up?
Yeah, so I was born in Washington, D.C., but moved to the Charlottesville area at about 1 year old and grew up here. I grew up in Albemarle County and went to Albemarle High School. Been involved in politics, you know, since I was young, got started as a Common Good Fellow with Tom Perriello's 2010 campaign, continued to be involved with politics at William & Mary, and after graduating, moved back here and worked with Habitat for Humanity Virginia and just continued to get involved locally.
Okay. And your education and your work background, how have they helped prepare you to serve as a member of City Council?
Yeah, so I think, you know, I've worked as an affordable housing advocate with Habitat for Humanity Virginia, given me a lot of experience working in the affordable housing world. And I think with that being such a major issue for the city right now, I think there's a lot of valuable experience there. I've also worked as a community organizer, co-founded Indivisible Charlottesville, have worked with the Charlottesville Low Income Housing Coalition. And I think we're at a moment where taking a community organizing approach to local government is really important. And I'd also say this as well, is that, you know, I make minimum wage. I was uninsured until Medicaid expansion. I have 40 to 50% of my income goes to my rent each month. So every day I worry about my ability to be able to continue to afford to live in Charlottesville. And I think that is a valuable perspective. I'm not a homeowner. I don't come from wealth or power. And I think that's a valuable thing to have on City Council.
You talk to me about that anxiety that one paycheck away from missing out on making your rent and being homeless. And that I think a lot of people in Charlottesville are sort of living that on the daily.
Yeah, I mean, it's common. I mean, we're facing an affordable housing crisis. Our rents are now comparable to Austin, Texas. 30% of folks in Charlottesville, according to the Orange Dot report, are not able to afford basic necessities. And I think it's a real danger for the city that working families are going to be displaced, and that the working class culture of Charlottesville, which I think is part of what makes Charlottesville such a great community, is going to disappear in 30 years unless we start to really change some of our policies locally.
Well, I think you just covered a lot of the questions we're going to ask, but we'll get a little more in depth with them in a couple of minutes. You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's Charlottesville City Council Candidate Debate Forum. I'm Jeff Leonard. In studio today is Michael Payne. Michael, I know most of the candidates for City Council, but you and I have never met, so it's my pleasure to see you. I watch City Council, and I watch on television or on my computer, and so I see you at City Council meetings most every week. For those people listening that haven't seen you, how have you been active in recent years to help improve Charlottesville?
Yeah, so I've been really active in the affordable housing world. Again, I've been an organizer with the Charlottesville Low Income Housing Coalition, where we've been fighting for the city to invest in redevelopment of public housing, fighting for zoning reform, fighting to have a comprehensive affordable housing strategy. I've also been involved in community organizing with Indivisible Charlottesville, co-founding them shortly after the 2016 election. We've done a lot of work focused first on Tom Garrett and now Denver Riggleman, trying to bring attention to some of the things they've been trying to do in Congress, like repealing the Affordable Care Act, the Trump tax cuts, and other policies that are just continuing to hurt working families. And with Habitat Virginia, have been involved with mainly statewide affordable housing issues, but it's tied in to a lot of local things as well.
Were you guys the ones with Indivisible to put the giant Trump chicken out in front of the Albemarle County office building? Was that you guys?
We did. Someone from Roanoke actually came and brought it. She was doing a road tour across Virginia to set up the Trump chicken, but she reached out to us to do it in front of the courthouse, and the county was not too happy with us.
I don't think the county appreciated the fact that you were out there with a giant Trump chicken. Running for city council is a huge deal. It takes a lot of sacrifice. A friend of mine once ran for Congress, and he wrote a book that said, I ran for Congress, and all I got was this lousy bankruptcy. What made you decide to run now?
Seeing that for working families in Charlottesville, folks are really struggling, and families are fearing their ability to be able to continue to live in the city, to afford basic necessities. And having gone to most council meetings now for about 3 years, seeing that there's been a level of breakdown of trust between the local community and city government, and there's been an inability of city council to unify around solutions that could help working families in the city. And I think there's no silver bullets, there's no easy answers, but there are things that we can do. And I hope that my experience as an affordable housing advocate and a community organizer can be a small part of helping to rebuild that trust and unifying around solutions that can actually improve people's lives locally.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's City Council Candidate Forum. I'm Bob McAdams, and with us in the studio today is Michael Payne. Michael, the events of 2017, including the debate and vote on the statues, the July 8th KKK rally, and the Unite the Right rallies on August 11th and 12th, they traumatized our community. They also uncovered covert racism embedded in our institutions. A year and a half has gone by. Where do you think we are now in race relations in Charlottesville, and where are we headed?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I just want to say, you know, I was there on July 8th and August 12th, and I always want to highlight that there's still a lot of people who are still suffering from those events of those days. There's still people with unpaid medical bills. There's still people dealing with PTSD. And I just want to highlight that even though those events are gone, the people who were impacted on those days are still here and they're still suffering. As to the wider point, you know, I think the events of the summer of 2017 brought a much wider recognition of some of the long-standing racial and economic inequalities in our community. They've been around for decades. They're not new. More people were aware of them. And I think now we're at a point where there's a greater awareness of all of these inequities, but the question is, what are we going to do about it? And I think we're at a point where we're starting to try and figure out, okay, what are some of the policies we can enact at a city level that can start to uproot a lot of these inequalities in our school system, the racial wealth gap, gaps in home ownership, displacement and gentrification in African-American communities, disproportionate minority contact from the police department, and all these other issues.
Many groups and many people in Charlottesville, and you've mentioned several of them already, have called for more affordable housing. But that brings up the related concerns about racial biases in zoning and gentrification. Now, which efforts by the city to increase affordable housing do you see as working and which aren't? And what further actions do you think the city should take?
Well, I think the city has been doing something really exciting and unprecedented with their investment in redevelopment of public housing. That is just getting underway, but they've made a substantial commitment in the draft fiscal year 20 budget. They've also made a big commitment to invest in the redevelopment of Friendship Court. I think those are really exciting, transformative projects. At a time when most cities are tearing down and privatizing their public housing, we're actually redeveloping it and building more. I think the city has struggled to come up with a comprehensive affordable housing strategy. I think we need to get there, because on housing, there's no silver bullets. It requires a range of different policies all working in concert. You need affordable home ownership programs. You need community land trusts. You need home repair. You need public housing. You need Section 8. You need zoning reform. And we're not at a point where the city has come up with a comprehensive strategy for how all these things connect and how we can invest in them. I think the city has struggled most, I think, in zoning reform. It's been talked about a lot, but the city really hasn't moved towards doing anything about it yet. The comprehensive plan is still not done. It's over a year late. Neighborhood development services, the city is not invested in them. We're not at a point where we're really even close to rewriting our zoning, which hasn't been updated in over a decade. And I really hope that we can start to really take that seriously, because if we're not talking about zoning reform and we continue to have over half of the city be zoned for single family housing, we're not going to be able to build affordable duplexes. We're not going to be able to do higher density in a sensible and strategic way, and it's just really going to set us back on the affordable housing issue.
City Council had a 1 or 2 day retreat, I think it was in August, to work on zoning issues. I'm not sure anything came of that. Did you go, or do you know anything that's come out of that, or is that still sort of pending?
To my knowledge, it really hasn't resulted in any actionable policies. There are some low-hanging fruit that the city could do. There was a Neighborhood Development Services efficiency study that showed that Neighborhood Development Services needs to have new staff and that its structure needs to be reworked some. They're the department that would be in charge of zoning reform, but the city just hasn't taken any action on following through with the recommendations of that efficiency study. And to my knowledge, there's really been no movement towards actually getting zoning reform. The Planning Commission has been discussing it, and they've put out some draft land use maps, but they still haven't passed anything, and we're not. There's no certainty about where we're going next.
To any consolation, that's been my experience also. Higher pay would make housing and everything else more affordable. As you mentioned, I think in your first answer, the Orange Dot Report showed the stark differences in income from one area of the city to another, often paralleling racial divides. How do you see the problem of economic inequality, and what should and what can the city do about it?
Yeah, so I think the issue of economic inequality, I really think, is the issue for Charlottesville, and particularly how economic inequality ties in to racism and our history of institutional racism here in Charlottesville. I think the Orange Dot Report showed that a living wage for a family in Charlottesville would be over $20 an hour. It showed that 30% of our city lives below the poverty line and is not able to afford basic necessities. In rankings of economic mobility, Charlottesville ranks in the third percentile nationally. We are almost at the absolute bottom for economic mobility. According to the Economic Policy Institute, we are one of the top 50 most unequal cities in the entire country in terms of economic and wealth inequality. So we have a lot of work to do. This is a very segregated city by class and race, and there are a lot of people who I think don't realize how hard a lot of people are struggling in Charlottesville. But if we don't take action on this, we're not going to be able to strike at the roots of the affordable housing crisis, racial inequality, and other issues facing the city. As to what we can do about it, I think increasing wages for workers is key. Because of the Dillon Rule, the state legislature doesn't allow us to raise the minimum wage citywide. But what we can do is continue to raise the minimum wage for city employees and school employees. We can support work that's going on right now to create a living wage certification campaign for local businesses to put up markers saying that they pay a living wage. And we can lobby the General Assembly to allow us to increase our living wage. And we also need to think about how can we create a comprehensive strategy for community wealth building? How can we think about how do we create a strategy for homeownership, investing in co-ops and community gardens and other initiatives that can help residents build wealth, generational wealth?
You know, I don't think people tend to understand is the more you pay, the higher quality of employee you attract and the more loyalty that employee engenders to their employer, cutting down on turnover, which in turn saves money. But I don't think they figured that out yet. New York Times ProPublica report on the achievement gap between races in Charlottesville City schools alarmed educators, students, parents, residents alike, including myself, who has children in the school system. Dr. Adkins, the school board, and everyone in the school division have tried to address this problem. What can you bring to City Council to help solve this?
Mm-hmm. Well, City Council's hands are tied somewhat because City Council doesn't have any control over how the schools spend their budget. City Council determines how much money they get, but they don't have any say over how it's allocated and what specific programs it goes to. So I think the approach I would take is on City Council to work closely with the school board, be meeting with educators to discuss how on City Council can we help promote equity? How can we help attack the achievement gap? How can we help attack issues like our African-American students in city schools being four times as likely to have contact with the police than non-African-American students. And to, you know, in any school initiative, ask the question, how does this address the issue of equity? How does this spending connect with the achievement gap? How does it connect with ensuring literacy and numeracy for every student by the third grade? And just trying to have that level of accountability with school spending.
Yeah, I think we need to acknowledge as we're recording this on Friday for a Saturday air, the the Charlottesville school systems are closed due to an active threat. And, you know, those are hard conversations to have with your children. And I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very sad. You know, it brings back a lot of memories for me of the summer of 2017. And I think it highlights that, you know, after the summer of 2017, we've experienced a lot of trauma as a community. And that is having a deep impact on students. And they feel this. And I really feel for students who, with these schools being closed, or, you know, being triggered with memories of everything that happened in the summer of 2017 and how that affects their ability to feel safe in schools. And I think it's why it's so important to continue to support school equity work and work being done by groups like the Albemarle Hate-Free Schools Coalition, and to remove racist imagery from our school system, and also, you know, continue to advocate for sensible gun control legislation so we don't have to have these constant worries of having to do active shooter drills and worrying about students, you know, every time they go to school, worrying about whether, you know, something terrible could happen.
Well, thanks, Mike. It's a great discussion. Michael, I apologize. It's a great discussion. Let me take a short break. And we're back. I'm Jeff Leonard, and I'm co-hosting with my friend Bob McAdams, a 94.7 WPVC election special interview with City Council candidate Michael Payne. Bob and Michael, we're talking about the issues.
And the issues don't get any easier. Having health care available is a need for all the people in our area, and lowering the cost of health insurance is another need for many people in the city. What role do you see the city taking to address the real concern of people receiving health care when they need it?
Yeah, this is, again, a huge issue that, again, ties into that issue of economic inequality locally. There was a period about a year ago where Charlottesville and Albemarle had the most expensive health insurance premiums of anywhere in the entire country. And, you know, I myself felt this until Medicaid expansion. I was uninsured. I didn't have access to health insurance because I couldn't afford it. And even with Medicaid expansion, there's still a lot of gaps because Medicaid doesn't cover mental health. It doesn't cover dental. It's hard to find providers. I think to strike at the roots of this issue, ultimately what we need is a Medicare for all system, which I continue to advocate for. But locally, in the meantime, I think we just have to continue to support local nonprofits like the Free Clinic, groups like the Women's Initiative, which provides free mental health services to women regardless of ability to pay, and other programs like that. The approach I take is that healthcare is a human right, and we can't strike at the root of the issue on city council, but I would ground everything we do in that value of viewing healthcare as a human right and trying to take that approach.
Now, you mentioned mental illness, and that's even more of a challenge for people who are suffering from it because the insurance coverage doesn't often cover that mental illness, and there's a lack of professionals in the field, and that means that many people with mental health problems just go untreated. What can the city do to help people with mental illness receive care?
I think we can, again, support some of our nonprofits, which are doing really great work on this, like the Free Clinic. And just earlier this week, I was at an event the Women's Initiative did where women told stories about their transformation and empowerment. And it was just a really powerful event that I think highlighted the power of the work they do. And I think, you know, we just need to continue to support those nonprofits, support organizations like The Haven and Pacham that are trying to provide service to the homeless. And again, it's tough because there's so much going on at the federal level where they're attacking our basic access to health care, trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, make changes with Health and Human Services to undermine it. And it's frustrating because as city council, you know, we can invest in things like the Free Clinic and try and give support to the Women's Initiative, and it makes a difference, but there's still so many people who are going to fall through the cracks until we get to a Medicare for all system. And it's, you know, it's, again, it's just one of the, you know, foundational problems of our country.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC, Charlottesville City Council candidate forum. I'm Jeff Leonard. In studio with us today is Michael Payne. Michael, talk a little bit more about mental illness and how it leads into our criminal justice system. Superintendent of the regional jail, Martin Coomer, who is a great superintendent and a very, very good person, says that 50% of the jail people in jail suffer from some form of mental illness, and 80% have substance abuse problems. What changes in our criminal justice system are needed, and what role can the city take play do to address these issues?
Yeah, I think, you know, something, a really striking fact to me is that the number one provider of mental health services in Virginia are jails. That's how broken our mental health system is. For many folks having a mental health crisis, the first provider they encounter is the criminal justice system. And you can read reports all the time of folks with schizophrenia, bipolar, severe depression, who have died in prisons in Virginia because the quality of care is so low. I think we need to think about decriminalizing mental illness and addiction. It doesn't make any sense to be treating those issues as criminal justice issues. They're health issues. And as long as we continue to use the prison system in that way, we're not going to be able to strike at the root of this issue. We're limited in what we can do on city council. We can do some things like trying to deprioritize and not arrest people for drug possession. We can do things like not enforce Virginia's habitual drunkard laws, which punish those struggling with addiction. We can continue to support organizations like The Haven and Pacham, which provide services for the homeless, many of whom are also suffering with mental illness and addiction. And I think we shouldn't be afraid to use our power on city council and our platform on city council to lobby for state-level changes. We do have power as a city. We do submit to the General Assembly each year a legislative packet that outlines Charlottesville City Council's legislative priorities. And I think we should go to the General Assembly and say, you know, look, you need to reform our mental health services in Virginia. You need to invest in them. You need to decriminalize addiction and mental illness. You need to reform our prison system. And just use our platform to do that and take a community organizing approach to these issues. Because there's a lot we can do locally, but again, if we really want to strike at the roots of a lot of these things, it's also going to require state-level change from the General Assembly.
Yeah, I made the mention, the note last week, that the quickest way in Charlottesville historically to see a psychiatrist is to get arrested and see the psychiatrist in the local jail. And the fact that that is a, fact is discouraging, and it should be discouraging to everyone. Statistics reveal another issue with the criminal justice system, systemic racism, from police stops to prosecutors to probation to incarceration. Whites have a clear advantage over people of color. What can the city do to make sure all members of our community can trust that the justice is equally administered by our police officers, prosecutors, judges, and prison staff?
I think the first thing we have to do is acknowledge that these systemic racial inequalities exist, that they've existed for decades, and that folks who have lost trust in police have legitimate reasons for that. And I think as a city, something that's really important is to support the creation of the Civilian Police Review Board and really support having an open, transparent process for doing that that leads to a civilian review board that is accountable and that has some level of control over police budgets and policing strategies, and that has full buy-in from the community. I think the Civilian Review Board can be a really great mechanism for rebuilding that trust and changing policies so that we're actually confronting the reality of what does it mean to change policies to reduce the discriminatory use of stop and frisk, where African-American residents are over twice as likely to be stopped by police than our white residents. What does it mean to reform JADE, where you're targeting people with addiction and mental illness and throwing them in prison or setting them up to become informants instead of focusing on other criminal issues? What does it mean to actually change policy to help demilitarize our local police department? All of these are things that need to happen and rebuild trust. It's not just about words and talk. You have to take action to actually change policies if you want to rebuild that trust.
So what I see from the CRB, the current iteration of the CRB that it's established right now is trying to create bylaws by which future CRBs will participate. Is that correct?
Correct.
Do you support, and I'm going off of media reports, which aren't always as reliable as they should be, that the current, what they're trying to do is establish subpoena power for the CRB and allow, some investigatory, you know, getting into the criminal files. And also the CRB is trying to get, I don't want to say control over, but maybe some input into hiring and firing and personnel decisions within the police department. Do you support that level of CRB, or do you, would you support more of a traditional form of that?
I think that is the right approach for a CRB, is to have those subpoena powers and independent investigatory power, because the role of the CRB is to be a citizen's ombudsman to what the police department is doing. And when you have a system where the police department internally is doing its own investigations, producing its own reports, and producing its own policy changes, you're not going to be able to build trust, because people are going to say, how is that independent? I think there's a lot of research about creating strong civilian police review boards. I know some CRB members went to a conference where these things were discussed. And so those policies are seen as best practices. They're not totally out of line or impossible to do. They're best practices. And again, I think it will benefit everybody, because when you have that kind of independent power, then you can rebuild trust.
Yeah, how... Outside of the CRB, what other things do you think the police and city council can do and city staff can do to build trust between the police? Because I agree, it's 100% broken. How does the community of color and police come together to rebuild trust?
Mm-hmm. Again, I think it comes down to changing policies, supporting the CRB, supporting strong and transparent data reporting in terms of stop and frisk data and other things that includes arrest data by gender and race, which the police department is starting to do. They just added race and gender to their recent initiative to release public data about stop and frisk, to explore policies to demilitarize our local police department. I know, you know, it was striking to me on July 8th and August 12th, just seeing hundreds of riot police with military gear and tanks on that day. And I think that's a huge problem. People see that. They don't feel that the police are engaged in community policing or part of the community. It feels oppositional. And we need to make sure that we're doing the exact opposite of that and really embracing a community policing model locally.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's Charlottesville City Council Candidate Forum. I'm Bob McAdams. Michael, recent reports from scientists tell us that the climate change crisis is much worse than previously understood. Young people are condemning the lack of action by older people who are the ones in positions of power. How should Charlottesville respond to the worsening global warming crisis?
For me, I think climate change is the greatest issue facing our society. I talk to folks my age, and there's often a conversation of, do I want to even have kids because of the world that they're going to inherit? And, you know, you read climate science reports, and it's frightening. And I still think, even among politicians who say they believe in global warming and that it's man-made, there's still not a widespread awareness of how severe the crisis is and how little time we have left to act. Obviously, as a city, we can't solve climate change alone, but there is a lot that we can do. And I think one thing is to divest the city from fossil fuels, which is something I've been advocating for, and we've had some success in city council at least expressing interest in it. The city's retirement fund currently is invested in the fossil fuel industry. The city currently uses a corporate bond from ExxonMobil. There's a precedent for the city divesting. The city divested from South Africa during apartheid. It divested from Sudan during the conflict there. And other cities around the country are increasingly divesting from fossil fuels, including New York City. And I think that's really powerful, and it's not just symbolic, because over 70% of fossil fuel emissions come from the top 100 corporations in the United States. Climate change is an issue of corporate power, And if we're able to pool our money and divest from the companies most responsible for the climate crisis, that has an impact. And I think it can also inspire other cities and other organizations like UVA to divest from fossil fuels. I think we also need to really think about how do we change our zoning and our transit policies to discourage car use and create a walkable and bikeable city with a strong public transportation system. I think investing in a regional transit authority that has regular stops every 10 minutes is really vital for reducing the city's reliance on cars. And finally, I would say, given the scale of the climate crisis, we need to be focusing on reducing emissions, but we also need to recognize that at this point, there are catastrophic impacts of climate change that are now inevitable. If we reduced all emissions tomorrow, we would still be dealing with significant impacts. And, you know, I was at a talk just yesterday that was going on from the Virginia Festival of the Book, and they were talking about building local communities of resilience. And I think we need to be taking that approach of how do we build local community resilience? How do we think about how do we invest in local community gardens, local co-ops? How do we invest in trying to have more local distribution networks? Again, thinking about the investments we make today are going to determine what the city looks like 50 years from now. And are we going to be strategic about making investments now that are going to help ease the burden of climate change? And again, there are cities doing this. Montgomery County in Maryland has done something really exciting where they've used land easements and some zoning changes to create a huge portion of their county, which is used for small farming now. Local farmers can lease that land, and they use what's called hoop houses to engage in small-scale agriculture, and they're using it to provide produce to the school system there. They're using it to provide produce for local businesses. And actually, Maryland is the first state in the country which requires a sustainability track in all public schools. And as part of that tract, local Montgomery County schools have students, as part of their education, go out and learn some of the basics of farming. And I think, again, these are skills that are going to be really important in terms of reducing our emissions and creating local climate resilience.
So I thought it was a great civics lesson the other night. I think it was two city council meetings ago when it was you and Mr. Swanson and Professor Heineke who got up there to talk about your divestment strategy that you are offering to city council. And you could really see city council looking at your idea and sort of buying into it. And I thought you guys presented that very well. So that's a very great civics lesson to children out there to say you can approach your government and make a difference.
Now, the city is going to be facing not just a climate crisis, but the population is growing, and that's going to place demands on infrastructure. How do you see balancing all these competing efforts for city resources?
I think that we cannot grow in a strategic way unless we're thinking about how do we grow sustainably and to reduce emissions. I think the biggest thing is reforming zoning and investing in public transit and investing in a comprehensive network of pedestrian and bike trails throughout Charlottesville and Albemarle so that as we become a more dense community and grow in population, that it's much easier for folks to not own a car or to not use a car to go to work every day. Right now, our public transit system is so bad that it's just not a realistic option for a lot of people. Right now, while we continue to make some good investments in pedestrian and bike trails, we're not at a point where it's a comprehensive network. So we have to get there. And I think the major piece of it is public transit. I think research shows that public transit does not significantly grow in ridership until you're having regular stops every 10 minutes. And right now, our public transit system is extremely irregular. The city did a study that showed that there is nowhere in the city where it is quicker to use public transit than it is to walk because the stops are so infrequent and unpredictable. If anyone has used public transit and tried to use the city's app, it is not very reliable. The routes change, stops change. Most of our stops don't even have covers. So if it's raining or snowing, you're sort of just left to be in the elements. And long term, we can't strategically invest in affordable housing. We can't invest in density if we don't have public transit as a backbone for that. Because people who live in the county, they're going to have to drive in, or folks feel like they can't live in the county and work in the city. And the General Assembly approved Charlottesville creating a regional transit authority, but they didn't find any funding mechanism. So, you know, we need to continue to figure out, okay, how can we bring Jaunt, CAT, the trolley, and UVA to the table to figure out how we're going to have a stable funding mechanism to support this transit authority and to continue to lobby the General Assembly to say, hey, we need funding for this. Because if we have a transit authority set up, which we don't have yet, then we unlock access to federal funds as well.
I'll give you a chance to expand on that. We need to change our patterns of transportation for many reasons. One of them is to reduce our carbon emissions. But the transportation must be highly effective in order to be accepted by the public, as you mentioned, every 10 minutes. What do you propose specifically that the city do to meet these demanding needs? And are they sort of lined up in a, can they be lined up in a similar manner?
So we sort of discussed a little bit already, but I would say specifically one of the big things that we can do is that the Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission recently created a regional transit partnership, which for the first time is trying to bring together UVA, Jaunt, Charlottesville Area Transit. And they're just beginning discussions about how they can start to coordinate. But we really need to support that effort because the barrier is that we have these three public transit systems, UVA, Jaunt, CAT, that are separate in terms of funding, separate in terms of policies, separate in terms of routes, and they're all sort of working at a crossroads. And to get to where we need to be on transit, they need to sort of be unified and be thinking about how they can amplify each other. And so I think, you know, we can continue to support that work and really lobby the General Assembly to provide a stable funding mechanism for a regional transit authority. Because if we have that, then I think the city and county would support actually creating it. Or even, you know, the reason it failed the first time is because the General Assembly didn't allow Charlottesville and Albemarle to propose a referendum to increase taxes to provide a stable revenue stream. So they didn't pursue it. And I think it's sort of a chicken and egg situation in terms of, I think the reason we haven't made progress on public transportation is because there hasn't been a mass of people continually demanding it. I mean, we saw how with affordable housing, you know, 5 years ago, the city wasn't talking about affordable housing and prioritizing it the way they are now. They've changed because of community organizing, and for a year plus, people going to every city council meeting and saying, take action on affordable housing. We need people to do the same thing on public transit if we really want to move the needle on it. But it's hard to get people to do that when the public transit system is so broken that people don't want to use it. And so you can't build a mass ridership until you've invested in it and have stops every 10 minutes. But it's hard to get a mass of people demanding that until you've made it strong enough where a lot of people are using it.
You know, future trends point to more people living in urban areas with high density populations. This means that more living units will be fixed in the fixed area of the city. Studies and practical experience show that humans need green space for their well-being and to keep the community sane. How can the city balance these two needs together?
Mm-hmm. I think we have to really invest in a strategy for how much green space we have. I mean, I know the county is actually really good about this, and they actually have percentage of land mass that they want to be covered by trees. I think we need to be thinking about that as well in Charlottesville, continuing to invest and support our public parks. And also thinking about, you know, when we're doing new developments like redevelopment of public housing and redevelopment of Friendship Court or any other high density apartment complex, there are ways and best practices in architecture to incorporate community gardens, to incorporate a small green space, to incorporate green space on the top of a building. We need to be figuring out how to incentivize that and support that. Again, not just because green space is really valuable for people's well-being, but I think green space is also a resource in terms of, again, helping people build wealth and health through gardening.
Well, thanks, Michael. We need to interrupt this discussion and take another short break. And we're back. I'm Jeff Leonard, and I'm co-hosting with Bob McAdams a 94.7 WPVC election special interview with City Council candidate Michael Payne. Bob and Michael, we've got one more segment to talk about the issues.
Michael, 2017 was a year of turmoil, and people showed their distrust, anger, frustration with City Council and long emotional meetings. What do you see can be done to restore trust and confidence and good order to the relations between City Council and the public? You talked about this a bit before, but now you can expand on it.
I think the first thing we have to do is recognize that in 2017, this city went through a traumatic event that made international news. It's only natural that after a traumatic event like that, that there is going to be a breakdown of trust and that there is going to be some dysfunction in local government. It's inevitable, it's natural, it's healthy as a response to something like that. And I think the foundational problem is the breakdown of trust between the community and local government. And so the question is not civility, it's not these other things, it's how do we rebuild that trust? And I think we rebuild that trust by taking a community organizing approach to local government and having the attitude that it's not just enough to have a good policy idea. It's not just enough to have an idea that you think would help benefit the community. You need to go out into the community, receive feedback, let it change your policies, build community buy-in, and then take action. Because if you're using a top-down approach, you're not going to be able to rebuild trust, and we're not going to be able to heal as a city. I think we are at a point where city council meetings are getting more cooperative and there's less opposition, but there's a lot of work to be done to rebuild trust. And again, it's not just about the summer of 2017. You look at decades of history of racial bias and policing. You look at the history of urban renewal. You look at the history of affordable housing and skyrocketing inequality and gentrification. There are legitimate reasons that people have lost trust in local government. And so we need to acknowledge that and change how we operate.
I think on a lot of issues, including climate change and racial bias and economic inequality, people have felt this pressure building for a long period of time and not seeing much happening. So that would be one approach, is to make something happen.
Absolutely, especially on affordable housing, because we have this dynamic where each election, every candidate says, oh, I'm for affordable housing. That's great. No one's going to say they're for unaffordable housing. But what does it mean in terms of action? And that's where city council has failed. They failed to have a strategy and they failed to enact it. And so people are seeing skyrocketing rents. They're seeing gentrification and displacement. And so when that's people's lived experience, they're not going to have trust in local government. And there's a legitimate reason for that.
Now, there are times when members of city council don't seem to get along very well, which makes working effectively as well as relations with the public even harder. If you're elected to serve on city council, what will you do to improve the working relations among city councilors themselves?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I would say I have a relationship with everyone who's currently on council. I have respect for everyone on council and am able to work with them. I take a community organizing approach, which is really working across differences and meeting people where they're at. And my approach is really, if I disagree with you on 7 out of 10 issues, but there's 3 issues that we agree on that we both believe would benefit the people of this community, I want to get to work on those issues. I'm not going to compromise my values on those other things, but I'm also not going to let it get in the way of us building a coalition around policies that we agree on. And, you know, I think there is a lot of overlap in terms of what we can do on housing. There is some agreement on that. And we just need to get to work to it. And again, I take approach of I want to meet one-on-one with people on city council. I also want to meet one-on-one with board of supervisors, school board members, people working in our nonprofit sectors, and figure out just how can we bring people together to take actions on the issues facing the city.
Now that leads us right into our next question. That the fundamental structure of city government's a mess. It's five part-time elected councilors, plus an unelected full-time city manager, plus staff. That would challenge the ability of any group of people to work together effectively. What do you imagine the city government could do to work better, to accomplish more, and what role does the state government have to play in this local dysfunction?
I think the state government has a huge role to play in the level of dysfunction. particularly because of the Dillon Rule. The single biggest barrier to progress in Charlottesville is the Dillon Rule. It's this old legal precedent from the 19th century, which says that state government has power over local governments in terms of state government has to approve policies before the local government can actually implement them. Not every state is a Dillon Rule state, but we are. And it means that we can't pass a citywide minimum wage. It's what prevented us from removing our racist Confederate statues. It's what prevents us from doing inclusionary zoning. And until that is gone, it's going to be really hard for Charlottesville to effectively address a lot of the issues facing our community. So I think a big thing that we can do is lobby the General Assembly to get rid of the Dillon Rule. And it's not unprecedented. Iowa, which is where the Dillon Rule was founded 50 years ago, got rid of the Dillon Rule. And on the anniversary of that, which is actually this year, 2019, there were parades all across the city and towns celebrating the return of home rule and the repeal of the Dillon Rule.
You know, in what areas do you think Charlottesville could best collaborate with Albemarle, the university, and other neighboring counties?
Mm-hmm. So I think there are three main areas where Charlottesville, Albemarle, and UVA not only can collaborate, but they have to. They really don't have a choice. And that is, one, housing. We need a regional housing strategy. It doesn't make sense to be talking about affordable housing unless we're also thinking about what the county needs to do and what UVA needs to do in terms of student housing. The second is climate change. There needs to be a regional strategy for reducing emissions and investing in sustainable communities. And third is public transit. We know that we need a regional public transportation system between Charlottesville and Albemarle, so they have to work together on it. And I would say on all three of those issues, collaboration is starting to happen. The Thomas Jefferson Planning District Commission has a regional housing partnership and a regional transit partnership where the county and city are coming to the table and starting to talk. And on climate change, both the county and city and UVA are actively setting greenhouse gas emissions reductions targets and thinking about other sustainable policies that they can implement.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's Charlottesville City Council Forum interview with Michael Payne. I'm Bob McAdams. Michael, you're running for city council. How do you describe your candidacy, your campaign to voters in the moment or two you have with them at a door or in an elevator?
I would say that I am an affordable housing advocate with Habitat for Humanity of Virginia and a community organizer with Indivisible Charlottesville. And I am running for city council because working families are struggling in Charlottesville, and we need to unify and take action on city council to help improve people's lives locally and really invest in affordable housing and tackle this issue head on.
The June 11th primary is coming up quickly, and to get elected, you have to win nomination to become one of the three Democratic candidates for city council. Then you also need to be one of the three winners in the November 5th general election. What is your plan? What organization are you building? How are you planning to accomplish those election goals?
We are running a grassroots volunteer-led campaign, and the core of our strategy is canvassing, talking to voters one-on-one at the doors, hearing what their concerns are, talking to them about affordable housing, inequality, and other issues, and going to as many events as possible. Pretty much every single day, I am at 3, 4, 5 different community events talking to voters and learning about the work that's being done in this community already by our nonprofits, by our advocacy groups, and just having conversations with folks about how can I, as a candidate, and if I'm fortunate enough to be elected as a city councilor, help amplify and support that work. And so it's really about trying to generate volunteer enthusiasm and momentum to canvass and build that grassroots support.
Now, every campaign needs to pay for the basics to get the candidate's message to as many people as possible. How are you raising the funds to pay for those basics of your campaign?
Mm-hmm. Well, something I decided as soon as I decided to jump in the race is that I would not be accepting money from developers or any corporate PACs. And the reason for that is we have to rebuild trust between the community and local government. And if you're making decisions on people who have donated to your campaign, it's hard for people to have trust. And so if we're serious about getting money out of politics, we have to start locally, and we can't continue to accept money from developers who are bringing forth special use permits and zoning requests that council will be voting on. Because of that, we're relying on small donors, a lot of online small donors, where we've generated some good enthusiasm going around the city doing house parties and other small events, again, for, you know, enthusiastic volunteers to help donate. And if anyone is interested in supporting the campaign, you can go to michaelpayneforseville.com, where we have a donate link. And really, even $5, $10 does matter. And again, you know, I make minimum wage. I don't have the ability to self-fundraise, and I don't have connections to wealthy folks who can dump a ton of money into my race. But what we do have is a lot of enthusiasm and momentum of small donors, and that's the way I would want to run my campaign.
Well, you do seem to have the activists, at least the local activists, motivated for you, as I was receiving lots of calls and messages as to why I haven't had you on yet. And I was like, man, he's coming on the 23rd. Relax. He's coming. So it's Michael Payne. What's your website again?
MichaelPayneForSeville.com, and we're also on Facebook and Twitter.
Okay. So I mentioned in the break when we were off the air, I wanted to ask you about your statement to City Council. You said that the Charlottesville needs to put up a down payment of approximately $100 million as an initial down payment toward affordable housing. Can you flesh out that thought for me a little bit more?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, people hear that number, $100 million, and it sounds scary and unfeasible, but it's actually pretty reasonable. The city's own Housing Advisory Committee, which is comprised of affordable housing advocates and affordable housing nonprofits, they try to estimate, okay, the city's housing needs assessment shows that we have a shortfall of about 4,000 affordable units. How do we meet that gap? And what investments need to be made to meet it? And what they found is that over a period of 15 years, it's going to require about $150 million. So about $10 to $15 million a year for 15 years. And that is investments in a range of different policies. That's redevelopment of public housing. That's redevelopment of Friendship Court. That's investment in affordable homeownership nonprofits like Habitat. It's investment in our local community land trust. It's investment in AHIP. It's investment in homelessness and building a second crossings. And so all of that combined over a 15-year period is the level of investment that we know we need to make if we are actually serious about meeting that full need of about 4,000 affordable units. And the city's budget can accommodate $10 to $15 million a year. In fact, in this draft fiscal year 20 budget, there is just short of $10 million invested in affordable housing. And if they decide to include $1 million of funding for the Charlottesville area, the CAF, the Charlottesville Affordable Housing Fund, it will be over $10 million. So the city is starting to make that commitment. We just need to make sure that we're explicit and honest about what we need to do. That's a big part of it. It's convenient to not be honest about the scale of the crisis. I'm not willing to do that. And, you know, if we're honest about it, as a city, we do have the capacity to make that investment. And fortunately, and hopefully, if we start to really gain some momentum on affordable housing investments, hopefully we can start to get a lot of matching state money and private grants, which is also incorporated into the Housing Advisory Committee's estimate. That $150 million is what they think is necessary in order to leverage state, federal, and private money.
A lot of the pressure on housing is coming from students, and the population at University of Virginia has grown over the years, but the amount of residents available on grounds has not. What do you see as the relationship between these problems and what the University of Virginia can do?
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things. I think one is for the UVA to explore using land that it already owns to try and build more student housing. That is not a perfect answer. It can help, but it also produces a problem in terms of UVA does not pay any property taxes. So if they are building student housing, that also means no property taxes on it. But I think UVA building more student housing on land it already owns can help. But really, I think UVA needs to pay payment in lieu of taxes. It currently pays no property taxes. If UVA paid the city the property taxes on properties it owns just in the city of Charlottesville, I forget the exact number, but I think it's over $1 million a year would come from UVA to the city. Currently, it pays none. UVA needs to help invest in local affordable housing nonprofits. Duke has done this. Duke has invested in a local community land trust to provide workforce housing for its employees. UVA can do the same. And UVA needs to continue to increase its wages for all employees, including contract employees. UVA is starting to take action on this, but we need to continue to support their efforts to take legal action against the contractors they work with to make sure they're paying a living wage to all employees, and to also recognize that it's a great thing that UVA is raising its wage to $15 an hour. I support it. It's great. But the Orange Dot report shows that a living wage for a family in Charlottesville is over $20 an hour. So 15 is a start.
Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time. Michael, thanks so much for spending this hour with our WPVC listeners. This is one of a series of election special interviews with Democratic candidates for Charlottesville City Council. All the interviews are available on podcast from our website, 947wpvc.org. We thank Michael Payne for giving of his time so that you, our listeners, can make the best choice for nominees for City Council. Next week, we have City Council candidate Brian Pinkston. He'll be in the studio for our election special interview.
You've been listening to the 94.7 WPVC Election Special Candidates Forum. The program is brought to you with support from Rebecca's Natural Food and Hamilton's at First and Main. Join us again next Saturday at 11 as we talk to yet another candidate for local office in Virginia's 2019 off-year elections. You can hear this program again or suggest questions for upcoming guests at 947wpvc.org or link to it through our Facebook page. Thanks for listening.